Is John Swinney really the Grinch for telling us what we kind of know about the likelihood of a normal Christmas this year? Or is he letting us get ahead of the game and actually having an opportunity to just de-escalate the whole emphasis on Christmas, which can be crushing for lots of people who don't live in nuclear families? We're looking as well at the plans that have been leaked to try to quell the move for Scottish independence, the plans to restore everything by simply having Baroness Davidson at the helm of a social justice agency set in Glasgow, and looking at how that all gets rather contradicted by the meanness of the free meals position for school children in England. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's The Leslie Riddick Podcast. And I thought I'd begin with a little explanation about the rather, strange postings of footwear last week. Leslie thought, I couldn't see it, you see, for the cat. You were in comfy moccasins, I believe, and I was in my wallabies. And just to explain what this was about, this was to do with the fact that I am pretty particular. I'm like these, folk may not know this, but back in the days of radio, initially, BBC News announcers used to dress up in full dinner jacket and bow tie to present the news, even though people couldn't see them. I, even though people can't see me, take off the slippers and put on a decent pair of shoes and a nice shirt just to get myself in this mood for broadcasting. I happened to mention this to Leslie and she says, take a photograph of your feet then. And so that's what we did and that's what it came about. This is not a, it's a most odd, but there we go. And people responded to it. And just to let everybody know, I'm wearing a chocolate brown pair of Clark's Wallabies this morning. That's what I meant. Right. Enough of that.
I can tell you, I'm in about layers because I'm in my usual outdoors position, just waiting for this wave of yuck to hit, you know, but with that sort of optimistic view that it won't until the podcast's over. So.
Yeah, because Leslie and I spoke at that point about, I said, Leslie, sounds as if you're playing roulette with the weather. And I said, have you ever played bus stop roulette? So Leslie went, there's only one bus.
There's one bus stop here and there is no daytime bus. So actually, that's a bit academic. So what is your bus roulette?
Right. Bus stop roulette is, well, you get down early for your bus. And what you try and do is try and get to the next bus stop before the bus arrives. And if you get before that bus arrives, you have to get to the next stop before the bus arrives.
So that's it.
Yes.
I've done that.
Yes. See?
And then you
see?
Obviously get caught in between. And you're constantly looking over your shoulder. Your adrenaline is constantly raised and it does you no good whatsoever, Pat Joyce. Leave it out.
Talking about adrenaline being raised, a massive kerfuffle about Christmas, you know, come about. I saw the John Swinney interview with Gordon Brewer. I saw the front page of the Sunday Mail. Appalling. And I've got a few points to make about how people spoke about that. But, you know, he said, gave a heavy sigh. And I think you've got quite a lot to say on this as well, Leslie, before I chip in. But, the grouch that killed Christmas,
Yeah, well, there's a whole thing here. I mean, obviously, people are not daft. Of course, the winter is depressing. Christmas has been, has essentially usurped pagan festivals around the same time because everybody that's in a dark part of the Northern Hemisphere needs to find things to kind of put the lights on, basically, back at that time of year. Historically, of course, it was, closer to New Year, to Hogmanay was the bigger Scottish thing than Christmas. And it has come in, but it has come in. So fair play, it's there. There's still nominally a Christian country. And then the next bit, it has been zoofed up within an inch of its life. I mean, now the pressures of Christmas, the pressures to perform, the pressures to be a nuclear family, the pressures to reproduce what you see on the television, the kind of slowly unfolding pressure of it all as it starts to kind of mount up so many days to Christmas, all this kind of stuff. At the moment, the relentless, shameless touting of Strictly, every outlet on the BBC, as if this kind of national treasure will just be enough to sort of see us right through the winter. And for many people, I mean, let's not be miserable. It kind of is something. I must say my addiction failed a couple of years ago and it doesn't do it for me anymore. But the basic point is, Christmas is actually, because it is such a pressurized time to do with family, family present, family absent, family difficulties, family attempts to resolve difficulties during stressful times when you're meant to be happy and have money and have presents. It's kind of, you know, can we just go easy on this a little bit here? Because there's also lots of people who live on their own, and the only stress of an entire year comes with the suggestion that there's something not right with you if you're not part of a family who will desperately, desperately be crossing the miles to try to get to each other. I mean, like, I do desperately get, generally speaking, to friends and whatever at New Year, but I know they're still my friends. I mean, I know that my family is still my family, my brother down in near Bath, and I know they're still there. It would be nice for us all to connect at Christmas, but this tremendous pressure on Christmas as some kind of almost, it's a proof of your humanity, it's a proof that you love people, it's proof of something far beyond the event itself. And you've got to point out that, you know, the number of marriages that fail just after Christmas, the amount of suicides there are in these dark months, there's just this, we can do without this superlative pressure on Christmas. Even just taking aside the COVID thing, it would be a great opportunity for us to just go, if you'll pardon the pun, cold turkey on this thing. Listen, I love the glitter, and I'll have, you know, a sawn down Christmas tree, and I, you know, I love all that, I love fireworks, I love all the childish things that I remember from my youth. I love all that stuff, and I do love seeing people and having them around and all the rest of it. But it is better for us to just slightly de-escalate the whole Christmas as a sort of totem of whether we can operate as a society, and just let it come back down the Richter scale a little bit. And with it, people who are brave enough to come into the public arena and actually kind of tell it like it is to us about COVID, as if we were adults, instead of what's happening south of the border, which is this suggestion, well, but which is the line taken by all Boris's frontline speakers, that Christmas will be something that has to happen. Yet another of these, again, you know, it seems English society is just full of totems that have to be observed no matter what. And it seems that that's what politicians think the voters want so badly. They're prepared to just tell any old hogwash to kind of keep that hope alive in the expectation of what? That you can outrun, you know, reality? That somehow you'll think about that later, probably later being about the 22nd of December. And then you really will be landing people in it, because they won't have had time to think about their isolated relatives. They won't have had time to plan around it. They won't have had time to think of relatively, if there is stuff, funky ways around doing all of this online. You know, I think now there's lots of parents trying to think their way around. Okay, so no trick or treat, no going around the doors and everything. Maybe we'll go back to a traditional kind of, you know, Halloween, and we'll have more of the lanterns and crack around the house and, you know, dressing up and silly things with one another. This could all be okay if we could just let go of the blaming culture in politics and the need to have these sort of totemic events that have to be done in a certain way that simply has been over commercialized for decades.
The end. Yes. Right. Yes. Yeah.
Now I feel better.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in a position where I come from a different tradition, so New Year wasn't that big a deal with us, coming from a Roman Catholic background, and I'll get onto that in a moment with Bishop Keenan. In that Christmas was always the most significant event for us because it was a religious celebration. We went to Mass, we took communion, and there was the Christmas dinner. But I'm with you on this to a great extent, Leslie, because I'm disappointed that I won't be able to see my grandchildren. I'm disappointed I won't be able to, my son and all the family, usually, you know, they come to us every second year. We'll have everybody in the house, and it's great fun. It really is thoroughly enjoyable. But hey ho, come on, let's just stop and think about why we're doing this. And as far as Bishop Keenan is concerned, number one, if anybody thinks bishops have got that much influence over people who still practice the religion, take a think, pal. You're not seeing families 7, 8, and 9 floating about these days, so they're not taking instruction on that. cackany. There's nobody going to be going or touching their forelock and saying, yes, Bishop Keenan, we're going to break all the rules. And again, everybody's actually turned around and said the obvious one, which is, yeah, during World War One, the Germans and the British soldiers actually agreed to having a ceasefire. COVID is not a sentient being. It won't suddenly stop for 24 hours. So, yeah, I'm with you on it. It's been fetishized. It's been blown up of all proportion. And as you said, completely commercialized, just like every other event. And as far as Halloween's concerned, guising is great fun. We did guising, but the vast majority of our time, we duked for apples. You remember, you used to put the scones with treacle on them, and you tried to grab the scones with treacle off the line, and we told ghost stories, and we sat with the neat lanterns in the house. It was very much based around the house. Very little guising. There was some guising, but they're very much based in the home. And I know that from my own daughter and son-in-law and the kids, they're actually establishing it within their own home, and they've been building it up within that. And they're doing it at home because they're no daft, you know?
Yeah. No daft. I do feel kind of guilty almost, because it is like being a terrible misery kind of saying all of this. And of course, you're only reflecting your own upbringing, mm-hmm. your own personal circumstances. But there's a presumption that everyone's personal circumstance is a merry, large family all the time,
exactly.
Who have got enough money to do all the things that, you know, are on the telly to do. And kind of, I just think there's a huge variety of types of household. There's more people living on their own. And kind of, it would just be great for us to be able to acknowledge now that there's kind of course, everybody loves to come together, but there's just it's like you pointed out there, even just the basics about the Catholic Church, you know, that the supposition that the bishop's comments will be acted upon feeds into a sort of narrative that we haven't explored either about where, you know, where ministers stand now in the kind of ranks of governing opinion. However, I think, again, his comments were picked up, I think, because they were useful to broadcasters who've decided this is the narrative.
And this
is what's kind of annoying me. It's because newspapers and broadcasters have now, instead of perhaps, here's a thought, we could get back into some of the boring old stuff that about our lives that keeps going on, like climate change, like adjusting to that, like all the stuff that used to make news until March 20th. That's all still bubbling away in the background. But it feels easier to have a sort of, you know, almost like a feel bad movie running where you just say, oh, my God, the dread. And of course, that's kind of whipping it up. You know, it's making it, it's legitimizing and kind of expecting and encouraging this feeling of dissent during winter months, which is part of a, you know, here, there's nothing that doesn't bring in huts. But, you know, I had a thing in the Sunday National, which was lovely that I got that space. And the way I was sort of approaching it there was this thing about, you know, it's far easier to embrace the winter because it is a seasonal part of our lives. If you've been outdoors kind of all the year and see it kind of coming and integrated into stuff, but also paradoxically, if you're able to get out and about in it, basically with some shelter. And it's just noticeable to me that particularly in Norway, it's the winter when everybody's sort of standing looking at the skies going, is it going to snow, with that hopeful expectation that it will? Because once it is, it's game on again. And that's what comes from a culture that expects to be able to be out and has little huts everywhere so people can actually get out and about. So all of that makes winter a different thing. It's not a sort of, oh, God, it's all going to, you know, the dogs now. And the only thing that will retrieve us is an over-commercialized Christmas where we can keep pretending that there's nothing wrong because that's the way we've been brought up. Stop it, everybody. Of course, you know, we want to connect with loved ones. But let's just try doing this by just going out somewhere, maybe. For once, without, you know, having to buy large things. I know that's blooming easier said than done when it comes to bairns, but sometime we're going to have to go cold turkey because the earth cannot afford us to keep this lark up, and we can't afford it for our own mental health. So come on, everybody.
The other thing was a way to say that I genuinely think that the motto for independence Scotland could be, aye, the knights are fair drawn in, because that's the attitude towards it. Well, it's dark. Again, I had a whole thing that which was I like going to football. And that was always outside. I always played sport in the winter, played football, played hockey, went to see sports. So the winter was always outside for me in these events, and that's stopped as well. But you're absolutely right, Leslie. I love the family. I love them coming round, and I do realise, as Jill said to me, that I'm slightly less emotionally attached to that whole thing. I because I see family all the time, even if it's on, you know, WhatsApp or FaceTiming, and just keeping that contact going. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it stands alone. Christmas, it's almost like a wedding day. Marriages mm-hmm. are not made by the wedding day. Marriages are made by what happens after that, best day, happiest day of your life. It's what comes after that. It's what goes on around that. If you're dependent utterly for your experience of being in a family and of being loved and loving on that one day, I would step back and have a look at what your priorities actually are. But you spoke about huts.
Oh, that's, honestly, that's so well said, Pat. That's exactly, sorry, I just couldn't kind of get to that, but that's exactly the point. It's all the time, contact all the time. And, you know, of course, special occasions. But, yeah, well said. Right.
Oh, yeah. Moving on, because you and I both responded to the article in the National on the rural stimulus plan that's come out of Deeside and Upper Donside SNP, the actual members up there, which is a 24-point rural stimulus plan. I think Fergus Much is one of the guy that's been spoken to about this. And when I read the article, it was a rather strange one because it focused almost entirely on this Parador thing that they have in Spain and the translation of that to Scotland, the National Trust and its need for money, etc., etc., etc. And I thought, well, this is distinctly underwhelming. And then, like you, I read the actual 24-point plan. So given that, what's your perception of that, Leslie, from reading more into it than probably most people and being able to see what most people haven't?
Okay, you can just call this Leslie the Grinch podcast, right?
Okay.
Because I mean, I know that people have put a lot of effort into this, but I still think it's just woefully short of the mark, actually. I mean, as I go through, I just looked at the bits that were going to be about community housing and land. So there's a proposal for community-owned energy companies.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, this is fine. And there are a lot of community energy-owned companies. I mean, I'm like a broken record here. It is an extraordinary amount of responsibility for local people to take on. And if this is our model of the future, that everything that is new and renewable and funky and reaches benefit to the local area has to be community-owned, then we're sort of prescribing really huge burdens for local people to manage without the structure of having small local authorities, you know, proper sized councils behind them. The idea of community owned energy, again, is fine. It's marginal at the moment. What are we saying is going to be mainstream? What are we saying will be the form of energy supply in an independent Scotland? I'd far rather see actually one proper thoughtful, thought provoking motion to the SNP conference simply on the future of energy in an independent Scotland, because are we leaving the big six intact? You know, I wouldn't have enough time to list all the problems there are with them, all the number of times they've been fined for accidentally overcharging, for tariffs that are deliberately set to try to kind of con people into paying more, to having fuel poverty at the levels we've got at the moment, which, of course, the rural stimulus plan mentions. But, you know, where do we think this fuel poverty is coming from? If we're leaving the big six intact and having essentially a privatised energy supply in an independent Scotland, then whoa, are we setting ourselves up for problems? And are we not really beginning to think creatively about what lies just in front of us? So to me, that's a bit of a problem with all of that. The Rural Housing Renewal Fund, it suggests, so that young people, particularly anybody, I guess, can get hold of derelict property and do it up or do something with it. I mean, again, this is fine. It's every time there's a separate fund for something, I sort of worry, because as we've discussed before, Scotland is absolutely beset by funds, schemes, pilots, stuff like this, all of which tends to suggest that the core problem is still sitting there pumping its problems out. So if you wanted to do something about this, there's a compulsory sales order idea which would let councils not order the purchase of something that's been sitting derelict because they don't want a derelict house on their books, but just they can order its sale, which just means something has to be done about it, get it on the road. Now, that has been discussed, debated, approved. It's been waiting to become legislation. It's been postponed, I don't know how many times. I've now given up asking the Scottish Government for any kind of projection. It was postponed because of one thing, then it was postponed because of COVID. So this is not a priority, it would seem. And yet everybody has been waiting for this CSO to come in as a way to try to kind of get the show on the road with dereliction. And yet, of course, if it was put in the market, guess who'd buy it? It wouldn't be the young'uns around the corner with tuppence halfpenny in their pocket because of land reform pushing up prices because, sorry, land ownership because of scarcity. So, yes, there is also legislation. The last lot of land reform stuff that went through in 2016, I think, brought in the ability to ask a minister to intervene to let a community buy a piece of land on the grounds of neglect. Now, as I understand it, nobody has used that mechanism yet. Nobody.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes it just, you know, what are we going to do? Just keep adding to the stock of stuff that's sitting in the corner that's a bit complex and not really. I mean, of course, the other big problem with all of this about dereliction is not the Scottish Government's thing. It's the fact that VAT is still levelled on doing any kind of repairs or renovations, whereas new builds don't attract VAT.
Right.
And this has been a problem. I mean, I can remember doing a thing about this 25 years ago. And there's been pushes, the Scottish Government's pushed to try to change that. But not, it's not in our power to change VAT. So that one stays there. But just changing the VAT regime would probably help a bit. Then you've got to ring fence and protect young people to get the land that is available. Which brings me on to the huge omission that there is in this, which is, what are we doing at the only thing people get in touch with me about second homes. Now, obviously, they're getting in touch because the huts thing kind of moves in on this and have discussed this before. On the face of it, it looks like, what? You want more second homes when people don't have first homes? But the point is, yeah, I want more second homes that are makeshift, in woods, designed to be temporary and not taking over existing housing stock, as in relieving the commercial pressure on existing housing stock. Now, in countries that are right on and have got tens of thousands of landowners like Norway, they still have laws to stop people being able to buy a first home for second home use. Denmark, the same. There's quite an interesting little exchange on Twitter with people coming in with examples of all the restrictions there are in Denmark, the Netherlands, New Zealand. Once again, if anybody took the time to compile the kind of restrictions there are, in Denmark, you can't buy a second home unless your first home is also registered in Denmark. And that was brought in, to be blunt, to stop the Germans coming and buying up their summer houses. But New Zealand has the same. Lots of people have those kind of rules, which just, again, eases the pressure on second homes. Now, we've got a situation where there's young'uns that get in touch with me who have formed an informal group. And I'm sure I'm not going to get the name of this wrong, but I think it's Young People for Rural Scotland. And they're supporting that statement that was made by some of the folk, young folk on the islands, talking about economic clearances. This is urgent. You know, it's urgent to get people, these young folk, not chucked out come the end of the winter when the winter lets once again are looking to get tourists in them. And another set of young people just, you know, reluctantly decide that living in rural Scotland is not for them. So where in this whole thing is something that comes in to protect them? We need it yesterday.
Well, well said, because what took me aback is I'm you know me, and I'm the same as you. I'm all in favour of a ground-up approach where it's people who live in communities come together and decide things. What I'm not in favour of is SNP policy, which is going to be Scottish Government policy possibly, being determined by a branch of the SNP. And this would have been an idea, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, a citizens' assembly where people who had knowledge and expertise could come together with what could be a rural citizens' assembly. I'm not saying it has to be specifically just for the whole of Scotland, but could be a rural citizens assembly, where people with expertise come in and add the value that you've added just now to the discussion, so they can see the points that have been omitted, not deliberately, because people genuinely don't know things. Because that was one of the major point that I thought, well, it's emanating from a branch who've done sterling work and actually putting this forward and start the discussion. I looked through it, land value tax, big yes. tick, rewilding, yeah, big tick. Yeah. But the other thing that got to me as well is that the landowners must be sitting thinking to themselves, that's by 2030, I think it's 2 million acres to be taken into public ownership. And I calculated with the last community by Langham Moor that they're trying to do, that's £1.4 billion being pumped into private landowners. £1.4 billion.
And that the point is, it's not going to happen anyway, because that was another point. It's a recommitting to the 1 million acre target. So basically, it's just saying there's a 1 million acre target. Yeah. We didn't hit it. Ooh, I wonder why.
Yeah.
And let's just recommit to it. Well, do you know what's going to happen in 4 days' time? Is that the buyout attempts at Killundin on Morvern Peninsula and Langham Moor, I think, are going to fail.
Yeah.
Not because they didn't get money from the Scottish Land Fund, which is what this advocate's doing, but because that wasn't even anywhere near the total market value of what they were aiming at. So it's kind of like, this is, and I mean, God, I really hate to be so negative, partly because the hut that I had was actually in Upper Donside. So if I ever go round the parish again, I'm going to get blooming pelters.
Yeah.
And as you say, it is brilliant that people are bringing forward motions to try to get sort of a rural package of something done. There is actually a rural parliament that is pretty useful and a functioning organisation that works for rural Scotland very well. It just never makes the headlines, because as soon as something's rural, even the word rural sounds sleepy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like community sounds worthy. And I mean, it's inescapable, these things. I spend my life in worthy, sleepy kind of areas, right? Which I spend a lot of time trying to zoof up. But the thing is, you know, this is all a large part of Scotland, just Scotland. So I would like to see normal, you know, measures, like if we could get some proper legislation going by consent between the SNP and Greens, because the Greens, in the shape of Andy Whiteman, have got a very good handle on the kind of levers that would quickly release the energy of young people that's sitting waiting to go, you know, just longing to pour themselves into projects and having to go through this stultifying rubbish that generations of their own families have had to go through, as if it's a blinking initiation rite to being someone who lives on the land in Scotland. It's just not good enough. And I'm sorry, I get so emotional about this, because why is it so difficult to just change the terms of trade in favour of our own folk? How difficult is that? But that's all that's needed now. That's what's needed now. It's got to be that big and ambitious, because people are alert to the kind of halfway house stuff that we've inhabited in all of this. And I'm sorry, but rural stimulus is just speaking the wrong kind of language on this. And I'm sorry to say that, but glad that it started this discussion.
Well, yeah, because it's the live horse, you'll get corn or jam tomorrow, never jam today, that we've talked about umpteen times. I did see a mention, I think it was about point 18, of the Preston model, and I'm never going to give up on the Preston model in terms of local procurement and fair pay and cooperatives that should be the core of what we're trying to do in Scotland and could also be happening now. And that's what I object to, is these things could be done now. And if you said eloquently, these are things, many of which have been in the pipeline, and I'm beginning to think to myself, is the Scottish government, the SNP, becoming so centrist that they're frightened to scare off big business and landowners the nearer we get to independence, because they perceive that as a way to garner support for independence and not frighten the horses.
Yeah, but I mean, dearie me, you know, I mean, we know what happened last time. The landowners wrote letters to their tenants telling them to vote no.
Yeah. However, yeah. Well, there we go. Well, thanks very much. That's again. That's Christmas done. That's Halloween.
Yeah, honestly,
rubbished.
Just make it Leslie the Grinch, right? I'm ready to take this because I can hear how blooming negative this all sounds. But you know, there we are.
Let's see if we can come up with anything cheerier that we're not going to rubbish, and we're not going to come up with anything cheerier because, lo and behold, Marcus Rashford, MBE, Manchester United footballer, roars back into the news, and everybody agrees with Marcus, apart from the UK government, about the provision of free school meals for kids in England during the school holidays. Because apparently, you know, they really, really needed it during previous holidays, but Christmas holidays, nah, you don't need it. And this started a whole thing in my head, Leslie, about the nature of poverty. And again, it's good works, it's charity. All these companies have got on board. Good on them for doing it, but, you know, let's have proper corporation tax and making proper contributions to society. We might not need your charity, because this is what it's fundamentally coming down to. It's been placed back, just like in Cameron's big society. The community is coming together to make sure, and it's brilliant that kids are going to be able to eat. But when we actually examine what's going on in terms of poverty, because that's what the key issue is, and what's happened since the Conservatives came to power with the Liberal Democrats in 2010, what's actually happened is, as the Joseph Rowntree Foundation has clearly indicated, there's been an increase in child poverty. And again, all those people who sit on the sidelines and talk about the undeserving, poor, etc., and that has been a major stream of thought that's been going on throughout this whole process. It actually beggars belief for me that somebody can turn around and say, well, you know, their parents are responsible, so the kids can't eat. Give us a break. If responsible parents, irresponsible parents, I really don't give a good goddamn. Children are entitled to be fed, to be clothed, to receive a health service, to be heated. You know, they're entitled to everything. And if you're actually going to turn around and say, well, it's because you've got irresponsible parents, yeah, that knocks a whole range of people out of the equation in terms of whether the children should eat or not. The bairns are innocent. Bairns should eat. I don't give a damn which political party you're involved in. That is a key principle. But you look at what's happened since 1997. Poverty in general is up 13% to 22% of lone families who are in work. That's gone up from 30% to 22%. Child poverty rate fell from 52% to 22%. 2010 is now gone up to 41%. You go through every single statistic, and by the way, it's what the definition the Joseph Rowntree Foundation uses is that if you're a single parent with two kids, he's 5 and 14, if you earn less than £19,400 a year, you're in poverty. If you're a couple, less than £24,800 a year. And it's there are also some figures that have come out as well, which startled me when I found them. If you're in the lowest earning 20% of the population, you're spending 50% of them are spending at least a third of their money on housing. And that has soared again over that time period. So in every single case, what we've actually found is that since 2010, poverty has got worse. People are having to spend more on food and housing in particular. And to turn around and see Tory MPs now rolling back from this because they misjudged the public mood, not because it's right, because electorally it's going to damage them, is disgusting. And I use the word Tory scum, and I don't tend to talk that way. But you've actually got spivs who don't care that they're ripping off people and the poor are poor. And then you've got the sanctimonious hypocrites who turn around and point the finger and say it's the individual's fault that you're poor. Your fault that you're poor. And guess what? Your kids are going to suffer. No, we've got an unfair, unequal society. And Scotland isn't much better when I looked at the figures there. It's 3 in 10 of 30% of children down south are in living in poverty. So out of a class of 30, that's 9 of them in poverty. Up here, 25%, so 1 in 4. So that's 7 or 8 of the kids in your class of 30 are in poverty. It's not right, it's not on, and don't come away with your sanctimonious, oh, I was misunderstood, Ben Bradley, when I actually said they were going to sell their food vouchers for crack. It's not on. It's appalling. And we should actually restructure society and move beyond the fact of it's up to the individual philanthropy and charity to actually fill the gaps that government should be doing. And in any decent society, that's what would be happening. We would not be questioning the right of children to a roof over their head and to be well fed and well clothed.
Yep. Amen to that. Nothing to add to that. I mean, that's absolutely it. It is just kind of surprising. I mean, shocking. Over and over again, though, how anybody thought that was going to sound okay.
Yeah.
Because there's just some things that are, especially when you know, we're sitting in this sort of, you know, situation where, as it were, the North has finally woken up. Andy Burnham has articulated a lot of the pent-up stuff that, you know, hasn't been said for a while. That kind of little moment of his standing on the steps there and just speaking like a normal person, in quite a defiant way, has kind of rallied quite a lot of kind of feeling back on a different axis, not the old, you know, the now traditional Brexit Remain axis, but back to a class axis as much as anything. So here this thing is slowly rearing its head again, and that there's all sorts of resonances that people were pulling in there. Peter Liu, you know, he was standing only about 100 yards away from the site. So, you know, those connections and everything are starting to be made again by people. And then while this, you know, the heather is just beginning to crackle, you take this issue, which has got to be the single one that is the most emotive for anybody because it concerns children. And also you've got a remarkably articulate black guy, Marcus Rashford. So that's also beginning to hit into the Black Lives Matter thing, which again has developed the presence of the black community again within our body politic. So here's all these kind of grassroots movements really beginning to get their voice and find themselves. And you say no to this, you know, so that kind of, and you think you can have a little splitting, you know, hairs kind of discussion over, well, you've put X zillion into something else and it's going to find its way to this, that, and the next thing. The only thing I kind of tweeted that I would just love to have heard, because I mean the media do sound as incredulous as everybody else on this one, is just to point out that Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, you know, have already committed to this.
Yes.
It's only England that don't seem to be able to think that this is a thing. It's just a seat. It's a seat belt. You know, it's like you're in a car and it's supposed to be safe and you're licensed to drive, but you still put a seat belt on. So it's like this is a seat belt for kids. Yeah, maybe this, that, and the next thing's meant to work. And let's not even waste our time going into how much it doesn't actually work with universal credit and everything. But this is just a seatbelt for kids, you know, so that if everything else goes wrong, that one thing ought to kick in. And I mean, that's it, that you just don't need to kind of be, you know, even Nigel Farage opposes this. You know what I mean? It's like, God almighty, how stupid politically, apart from anything else, you know, morally, of course, you're not even right. You're not even sort of looking on that Richter scale when it comes to this lot. But just even, you know, as a kind of space of self-preservation, it's just extraordinary, you know. So anyway, who knows? I mean, it seems that Keir Starmer is still thinking of bringing that back, which will sort of test the Tory ranks to the maximum, which is like a nice little Christmas present for all of us. But hopefully it would result in some action for the kids, except that it looks like a lot of councils are just going to unilaterally step forward. And there's another thing you don't want to have happening if you're a Tory prime minister. You don't want all these councils beginning to make common cause across political divisions in the north of England, stimulated by you and your meanness. You know, nice one.
Yeah, because what I did is I took a look at some of the stats concerning the prevalence of free school meals, and the top 15 authorities, six of them are in London, between 27% and 33% of kids, which is the average across England is 70.3%. Then you look at the real top ones, 31% to 34%, Blackpool, Manchester, areas of Liverpool, etc. All the places that are currently, guess what, in tier three. Yeah. And let's just put the boot in twice here. And on a personal basis, I mean, I tweeted about this. I'll never forget to say, and this is, it's seared into my memory when I went to St. Mary's Ford Bank up the hill town. And that was my first real experience of seeing kids with nothing. And I recall kids coming to school, one lad, all he had was a pair of his dad's football boots to get him through the winter. That was solved, again, through personal charity. The other thing I remember, and to this day, I can remember the colours of the checks you used to get, because I had to pay for my school meals, which was a bob. So that was turquoise. Then you had red for 11 pence, green for 10 pence, and I think it was white if you got it free. And I remember my pals having to put the white checker in their to show that they were getting a free school meal. Not on. People should have enough to live on without having to expose themselves to that. And nobody was nasty about it, but I thought, my God, to be in that position. So you had to have some calculation that everybody who was entitled to a free school meal was getting it, and then you were ID'd as that as a 5-year-old. Anyway, so, but looking at the political machinations, of course, this comes back to Parliament, and we have Douglas, I'm going to abstain, Ross, but the five other Scottish Tories are going to vote against the provision of free school meals for kids in England. And now Douglas Ross has turned around and says, we're going to change now. And just to show I'm different, you know, and just to show I'm in charge, lo and behold, we're going to abstain on English votes only now. Does anybody buy this nonsense? Have we not
But look at what they're up to. I mean, all of quite apart from all the, you know, back chat and the leaks that have been revealed about the sort of secret plans, you know, to have kind of spike the guns of the nationalists and all the rest of it. I mean, there's all this kind of, you know, what we really need is just then fill it in. You know, Tim Montgomery from Conservative Home has got his. What we really need is Ruth Davidson running a social justice agency from Glasgow.
Wow,
it's almost like, good, that's fine, it just proves that we're not mad, they're crazy, these guys, you know, we need away from these people. If anybody thinks that, I mean, just it's hardly even worth starting with that, just some overarching this, oh, you know what we've got to do when we're doing everything else, social justice, God, it's just like, it's like that Tabasco thing, you always forget in your recipes, oh dear, you know, so we just need to get some, put it on the shelf, and then keep remembering to use it occasionally, you know. I mean, it's just that this is so not the way Scots think. I mean, I think even Tories in Scotland are kind of more like, to as far as I can see, most of them are more like a kind of you know, the old one nation idea, or the sort of Nordic Tory, who still thinks that you want some sort of coherent government. But this idea, the sort of patchwork, you know, oh, something we've got. What do the Scots like? They like social justice and they don't like poverty, and, you know, they don't like injustice, and they don't like Australia. They don't like Dominic Cummings. So, but they did seem to like Ruth Davidson once, but she's a baroness now, but that'll be fine. And they don't like the Lords. Okay, so, but what we'll do is we'll just stuff her there. And you think, right, just for one scary moment, everybody, just imagine that way of thinking is governing our country.
Yeah.
Every problem is just, you know, I've been watching Roadkill on the iPlayer with Hugh Laurie there as kind of like, you know, a Tory that's looks like he's about to get his comeuppance. But all of it, I mean, all of these political scenarios are full of, you know, what can we do to just, you know, to just plug the gap and limp through, and quite evidently all the thinking that's coming forward is just that sort of level of tokenism. We'll give them something, give them this, give them a bung, give them some attention, like a wee doggy, you know, the doggy's barking, give the dog a bit of attention, right, fine, give it a bone, that's great, it'll go away for a while and you can get on with the rest of your life. This is just, you know, we're so past that, honest to God, it's just extraordinary. Listening to this stuff.
Yeah, they're completely cloth-eared. And like everybody else, I'm saying, great, put Ruth Davidson in charge of stuff here. Great, get Michael Gove to set up a union unit up here and try and tackle the pro-SNP and independence bias there is in the Scottish media. Would that were true. Come on, do it, because every time you come up here with that tin-eared approach, you're driving more and more people who are cultural nationalists, but probably not ones who would support independence, and are trying to say, that's enough. This is just ludicrous, and it's pushing them to that. And as you said, precisely what it is, it's that patchwork approach to sticking plaster here, sticking plaster there. We'll put it there. We'll try and stop the leaks. You know, you've got to go to the sources you identified with the drainage a few weeks back. You've got to go to the source. They've blown it completely. If people like Tim Montgomery, who's supposed to be this political guru, thinks that Ruth Davidson is going to solve the problems up here. But St. Ruth always had a greater reputation down south than she ever did amongst the Scottish electorate. Talking about elections, did you happen to catch the Donald Trump interview on CBS's 60 Minutes by any chance, or did you avoid it like
no,
the proverbial?
Having seen it so well trailed and everything, I thought, well, there's one I probably don't need to actually hear, but do tell.
Oh, absolutely appalling. It was a masterclass in narcissism, in being thin-skinned. I suppose it appeals to his base, because unlike Pence, who followed up afterwards, who actually sounded like a politician and sounded reasonable and thoughtful and is taking on board what was being said and moderated his tone, Trump was just over the top, completely over the top, and petulant, childish. I mean, it's an insult to a child. Most children are far better behaved when I actually speak. Mm. And I thought it was absolutely dreadful. And what you also, again, in addition to that, was that Amy Barnett Barrett was actually confirmed as the new Supreme Court justice. I think it was yesterday. So literally a week or two before the US elections, bang, they now load the Supreme Court 6-3. It's been an interesting one in observing this, because I'm like everybody else, I'm fascinated by US politics. But on the other hand, I'm kind of like the old song by The Clash. I'm so bored with the USA. What happens is that people I know on the left get fixated with what's going on in the States, and isn't Trump appalling, and isn't this and that and the other, and entirely distracts from what's going on here. It's that vicarious, the States has always looked bigger, better, brighter. It's in the movies. So yeah, it's dreadful what's going on there. It's America. Let's concentrate on what's going on here. And to react to Joe Strummer, I am so bored with the USA. He won't get in, he'll get in, the world will go on, hopefully. The only thing I will say about that is that Biden, even though I'm not utterly convinced by him, Biden and the Democrats will be on the same page, hopefully, as the rest of the world in terms of climate change and the environment. That's the big one as far as I'm concerned, because they go on about the appointments of the Supreme Court, and one of the key issues there is not only the overturning of Obamacare, but the complete rolling back of environmental protections, which can emanate from the re-election of Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does seem, I mean, it was portrayed as a big slip by Joe Biden to, you know, finally put that into kind of the concluding part of one of the debates. But on the other hand, it's an important commitment and, you know, one we've all heard said out loud now. So, I mean, you can only hope. I mean, we have all know the vagaries of the Electoral College system and the fact that, you know, the majority of the vote can go one way. And it seems to be in the end that Republicans can just still limp home.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it will be an enormous thing, however, if that, you know, Trump, who is the kind of totemic head of populism across the world, if that man is toppled, and OK, you know, he's saying he's not going to go and all the rest of it, all that, he will be gone. You know, it may take a little bit of time. It may be unpleasant. The Americans will have to rouse themselves. The complacency that's always existed about the, you know, excellence of the separation of powers that we all got dinned into us if you went that far in school. Yeah. Actually, you know, there's lots of other little countries that have got far more effective separations of powers. You could just look at them sometimes and, you know, learn, all of us. But, you know, so that might just wake this huge wakening up thing, actually, for the American establishment. But they will find a way to get the problem resolved. If, you know, the Electoral College votes for Biden, then Trump will. It could be awkward, of course, with the Supreme Court and everything. It's hard to see how that one, you know, finds its resolution. In the same way as, you know, quite evidently, we've got the old 58% for independence here. So you could fixate a lot on how that is manageable when Boris Johnson just keeps saying no. And that bores the arse of everybody here, actually, to just keep having to repeat that scenario. I mean, standing back a little bit, I'll grant you it's a tricky one, but standing back, nobody remembers the tricky things. You know, in the end, there is a sort of current running, and it's the currents that sort of in the end find their own furrow, especially with drainage. So, you know, it's going to happen. And we've got to keep our eyes on that one. I was interviewed by this lovely guy, Johannes Trala from Estonia, a couple of weeks ago, And he put up, he's done a program. The program he does is Johannes Travels. And he travels around the place doing these hilarious kind of but really insightful and beautifully filmed series about each different country he visits. This on a motorbike.
All right.
With a kilt.
Okay.
So, right, yeah.
That's interesting.
and he just branches into folk, basically, and not in an aggressive way, but just in a really kind of like, hey, cool, you know, sort of kind of Northern European way. Hey, you know, what do you think about this? And it's the most incredibly vibrant sort of almost non-political program I've seen. It's so funny. He's got people at bus stops talking. He's got people sitting outside fish and chip shops talking. He's got women inside a kind of coffee kind of place talking. There's a, to my mind, healthy disproportion of people who are mad keen independent supporters, which is fine. I'm in it. Angus Robertson's in it. He goes to the most unusual places. He went to Maryhill Borough Halls and was shown a room that has stained glass, which apparently is the only stained glass, I think, in Europe, which is secular.
All right. No idea.
Tribute to all the different trades and everything. I mean, absolutely beautiful.
And I go past that umpteen times on the way
Well, that's what I thought. My mother used to live just past that. So it's kind of like, I didn't know that. It's a fresh feeling. If you're watching that, a bit of you goes, wow, is this our country? It's so kind of vibrant. People are up for things. And another small thing I noticed, which is a big thing that I used to do when I was especially doing recording the thing on the Riddick and the Outer Hebrides when I was cycling up the Outer Isles and talking to people, I always recorded them standing up. and preferably after we'd just done something or even in the middle of doing something. There's something about the doing brain and the upstanding brain, which we're also discovering for making our own film about Estonia at the moment, because the people that we've interviewed, a couple who are sitting down, are a lot less animated than when I'd spoke to them, you know, earlier when they were, just standing on the street corner. So there's something really, the method of doing that whole filming is incredibly clever, because it's almost like catching people's, you know, if we're asked to do a proper interview, everybody stops, worries about their accent, tries to remember grammar, remembers what their mum thinks they ought to have said if they were ever in front of a camera, pulls their tummy in, gets all clenched up, and then says something pretty unmemorable. Yeah. Whereas what he's managed to do is just juke in and catch people before all of those things kick in. And it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I've tweeted and put the thing me up on Facebook as well. And I know there's big wadges of Estonian in it, although it is kind of like a highly amusing language, because there obviously is quite a lot of Scottish words in the middle of it. But there's so many drop-in bits of these fabulous groups of Scots that he's encountered all over these cities. It's just like a total breath of fresh air. So I highly recommend it. What I was also thinking was it would be great if something like BBC Alba was to take the whole blinking series. I can see that the balance issues might kick in with a Scottish one and just put subtitles on all of it, because you've got a sort of, you know, North European similarish kind of outlook from a really brilliant young presenter. And he's gone all over Europe on a motorbike. I mean, what's not to like?
It sounds great, and I'm looking for things to watch, because I've run out of episodes of Salvage Hunters, The Restorers, which I can recommend everybody, which is absolutely excellent. But the language bit kicks me into a couple of things. It's award season, and congratulations to your good self on the Fletcher of Salton Award for contribution to public life from the Salt Art Society. Well done.
Aye. Well, thank you very much. I know.
Brilliant. And it was the Scottish Language Awards, and congratulations in particular to Paul McNichol and Ronnie Costello of the Dode Fox podcast, the Dundee United podcast, because they were the Scots Media Persons of the Year. So fantastic. Yeah. Lots of Ali Heather presented it, our friend from the Scots Language Programme. He He actually focused on the Dove Fox podcast right at the beginning of that programme. And these guys are brilliant. If you don't support Dundee United, don't bother. Well, sorry, that sounds awful. It is worth a wee listen just to hear two guys talking authentically off the top of their head about things they feel passionate about. And they're genuinely funny. No thought processes involved whatsoever. What you hear is what you get. And they're absolutely brilliant. And it is a genuine breath of fresh air. So, fresh air, that's my weekend sorted. I'll be having a wee game of golf. And are you doing anything particularly interesting at 6 o'clock this Friday, by any small chance, Ms.
Well, 6 o'clock tonight.
Tonight.
Yes. Is Nordic Horizons is back on, basically. We've had a year off kind of cogitating, during which time, you know, suddenly COVID hit. So kind of the model that we'd had before of having physical meetings in rooms, obviously, you know, that's over for a long time. So, yeah, we're back. We're on the Zoom, as everybody else is. We've got six speakers, one from each of the Nordic countries, you know, the mainland, Scandinavian ones, plus Iceland and the Faroe Islands, all talking about how COVID has hit them. I mean, how their countries have coped with COVID. They're not speaking for their governments. They're not politicians. They're not even, I'm not sure if there's more than just one who's a medical expert. So this is not a kind of big, you know, punchy, hey, you know, but that's not this, and, you know, attacking people for stuff. But it's just trying to understand what it's been like to live in those countries during COVID. And there's still tickets. We're old business Zoom license, so we can handle a lot of folk. My goodness, a plane. My God, This is a red letter day. That's a really weird looking plane. Of course, I'm just flying from Lookers, so this occasionally happens.
Big, I can hear it.
Plane. Right. Yeah.
No expense paid. We flew a plane in, just to let you know, this is recorded live outdoors.
Yes, just so. So anyway, if anybody wants to join that Zoom, mm-hmm. you're very welcome. The link is on the website nordichorizons.org. nordichorizons.org is an Eventbrite link. Click on it. You get set a link. You can either join via the Zoom link that sent you, or go back into the Eventbrite and you'll find one link there too. So, you know, come on down, as it were.
Well, that's Leslie's plugged on for Nordic Horizons. And I've got a plug that I'm going to be putting out for the both of us here. Lots of folk over the years have asked us how they might be able to support the podcast. And we've given this a lot of thought and would like to get your ideas and opinions on how you might be able to do this, and should we go ahead with it. So what we've done is we've put up a wee survey on leslieriddick.com/podcast. And if you go in there, complete the survey, as I say, we'd like to get your opinions on how we can take this forward or not. So two plugs done, Leslie's, mine, and we'll see you next week, chums.